Welcome to Heart of Iowa on KHOI Community Radio, a program featuring a patchwork quilt of artists, public speakers, and individuals of note in central Iowa. Today's broadcast is a lecture presented by British author Alan Wiseman as part of ISU's annual conference on wildness, wilderness, and the environmental imagination. Wiseman made quite an impact with his 2007 book, The World Without Us, which explored what would happen to Earth if humans suddenly disappeared from its face. His most recent book, Countdown, subtitled Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth, addresses the problem of geometric population expansion in the face of finite and diminishing natural resources. Here's Alan Wiseman speaking on the ISU campus in February.
For those of you who don't know my last book, The World Without Us, all you need to really know about it is that I actually wrote it because I want a world with us. It was a thought experiment that theoretically wiped humanity off the map in order to show how quickly the Earth could heal and refill empty niches when relieved of the daily pressures that we heap on it. My hope was that once readers saw this picture of a newly restored healthy planet, they'd be inspired to wonder if there might not just be a way to add us back into the picture, only in harmony and not in constant combat with the rest of nature. But in trying to determine exactly what that nice natural balance might be, I ran into a troubling fact. And that's that every 4.5 days we add 1 million more people to the planet. And that didn't sound very sustainable. So at the end of The World Without Us, quite unexpectedly even to myself, I ended up trying another thought experiment. I asked one of the world's most distinguished demographic institutes, it's in Vienna, to compute, setting all social implications aside, what would happen if we all participated in China's one-child policy? And the surprising answer was that by the end of this century, we'd be back to about 1.6 billion people, which was exactly the population of the Earth at the beginning of the 20th century, before we suddenly doubled our numbers and then doubled them again. Now, that would give us and other species a lot of breathing room. Let's be serious. None of us want some government telling us what to do in our bedrooms or in our private lives. The nature part of human nature is to make more copies of ourselves, as it is with every other organism. So instinctively, the idea of being forced by someone else to put the brakes on doing what comes naturally is repellent. And, of course, we've all heard of the worst excesses of China's policy, ranging from forced abortions and sterilizations to actual cases of infanticide, especially female infanticide. Still, China's one-child policy, which was implemented in 1980, may be the reason why there are 400 million fewer Chinese today than there might have been otherwise. But realistically, a plan like that is just unacceptable anywhere else. And then there's the question of whether it even matters that every year we add all those people, which is the equivalent of 4 more Beijings or 10 more New York Cities. The week that this book, Countdown, came out, there was an op-ed in the New York Times that argued that the more people there are, the more human ingenuity we'll have to solve problems like how to feed more of us. Now, although that sounds like circular, if not magical thinking, many pro-growth economists argue that we can have our planet and eat it too. But the question that I left dangling at the end of The World Without Us, namely, what is the sustainable carrying capacity of this planet for our species, factoring in our consumptive habits? That became one of the main things that readers of that book wanted to discuss with me. But it's a loaded topic, loaded with conflicts, so much so that most environmental groups don't dare touch it, even though nothing affects the environment more than us. As one woman observes in this book, Countdown, the population question is where natural science and social science come together. It's actually more like where they collide. Because it's easy to grasp that in a national park, balance must be maintained between predators and prey, lest the ecosystem crash. But when it's our own species, it gets a lot harder. So I decided that I needed to examine this, not as an advocate or a foe of population management. Explore it as a journalist, researching and weighing the facts from as many kinds of sources as possible. I also traveled to 21 countries in order to find not just facts, but evocative stories to make it a compelling read. But about those facts, look, I do not pull any punches in Countdown. We are facing some serious challenges in this century, and much of it likely will be a wild ride through uncharted territory. The number of humans on this planet is far more than nature ever intended, and our demands are changing the atmosphere and the chemistry of the oceans and our soils in dangerous ways. There hasn't been this much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere in 3 million years, when the seas were 80 to 100 feet higher. Nevertheless, I came out of this book far more encouraged than when I went into it, because I found something easily affordable that we can actually do that will make a huge difference, and there's already a lot of momentum and precedence for it in nearly every part of the world. Now, my research for Countdown boiled down to four basic questions. Number one, how many people can fit on this planet without tipping it over? Number two, how much nature must we preserve in order to ensure our own survival? Can we possibly know what other species are essential to us before we wipe any more out? Three, if the Chinese policy is so unpalatable to most other people, is there anything in the histories or the holy books or the current circumstances of the broad swath of the world's cultures, religions, nationalities, etc., that might embrace the idea of, so to speak, refraining from embracing so much in a time of crisis? And to answer that one is another reason why I traveled to all those countries. And four, if the safe number of humans turns out to be less than the nearly 11 billion we're headed to by the century's end, or even less than the 7.2 that we're already at, 7.2 billion, is there a way to design an economy that doesn't depend on perpetual growth to prosper so that we might gradually bring our numbers back to a healthy level and keep them there? More than one expert I interviewed remarked that those may be the most important questions on Earth, but they may be impossible to answer. And my reply was that if those are the most important questions on Earth, we damn well better try. But like I said, they're loaded. And that's especially true when there are political and religious pressures to be fruitful and multiply, to build a mighty tribe or nation. I start Countdown in one of the hottest examples, Israel and Palestine, where extremes of both are bent on outpopulating each other in a land much of which is a sandbox. There are ultra-Orthodox Jews having double-digit families in hopes of becoming the majority in the land versus what was once called Yasser Arafat's biology bomb, the Palestine Liberation Organization's secret weapon, the Palestinian leader used to say, was the Palestinian womb. I began there because to Christian, Jew, and Muslim alike, this is hallowed ground, a place that evokes powerful emotions in most humans. I figured it would get people's attention. Now, before the State of Israel was created in 1947, it was under British mandate, and British ecologists calculated the carrying capacity of the Holy Land to be 2.5 million people. Founding Zionist and first Israeli Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion, however, argued that Jewish ingenuity could make the desert bloom. He believed that the land could hold more than twice that, 6 million. Well, today there are nearly 12 million jammed between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River. And by the middle of this century, at current growth rates, there will be 21 million and a lot less water. I met Palestinian and Israeli ecologists, water experts, demographers who were frightened about these growing numbers. Both a rabbi and a Quranic scholar cited the story of Noah, to whom God told that in order to save the human race, he also had to save all the animals. We can't have a world without them. But I also met the ultra-devout on all sides who believe that it's God's will to have more children and that God will provide for everyone. Now, ecologists sometimes talk about what they call the Netherlands fallacy, namely that the fact that so many Dutch who live in Europe's most densely populated country, the fact that they have such a high standard of living is not proof that humans can thrive in essentially an unnatural artificial environment. And yet I heard that argued in Israel. One ecologist calls it their technological optimism, the idea that smart humans can solve anything if they put their minds to it. Like all of us, though, both the Dutch and the Israelis need things that only an ecosystem can provide, and they must purchase those things, most of them, from somewhere else. The northern half of the Holy Land, by the way, where most Israelis live, is already nearly twice as densely packed as the Netherlands. Now, another ecologist who was also a Talmudic scholar cited the story of Joseph, born at a time when the Israelites were polygamists for the same reason that the Mormons later were. It was a strategy to have many children so the tribe would grow quickly. But Joseph, you know, the son of Jacob, correctly noted that a time of scarcity was imminent. Even though he was one of 13 children himself, unlike his polygamous forefathers, he confined himself to just one wife and two children, and advised Egypt's pharaoh and the Israelites that it was a time for everyone to conserve instead of expanding in order to save themselves. And I have a modern example later in the book. Among the countries I visited that have discovered completely voluntary ways of bringing their population down is one that surprises a lot of people because it's a Muslim theocracy. The same year as its 1979 Islamic Revolution, Iran actually applied coercion the opposite direction, charging every fertile female to do her patriotic duty and get pregnant to help build a 20 million man army to fight off the invading Iraqis. And by some estimates, at one point, Iran's growth rate peaked at near the biological limits for fertile women. They had the highest rate of population increase, 4.2%, that the world had ever seen. Now, some of you may know that Saddam Hussein invaded Iran, hoping that he could easily seize an oil-rich province on their border because the new Islamic Republic, he figured, was still barely organized and it would be easy pickings. You might also recall that NATO supplied much of his armaments, including feedstock for nerve gas. Iran, which did not have much sophisticated weapons technology, simply responded with repeated waves of soldiers, enough to hold Iraq to a stalemate for 8 years. And today, wherever you go there, you see billboards filled with rows of pictures of locals who were among the million Iranians who were martyred in that war. But once it was finally over, the director of Iran's planning and budget office, an economist, realized that they had big problems. All those males born to man the 20 million man army would eventually need jobs, and the chances for providing them shrank with each new birth. So he and others met with the supreme leader to warn of the instability of a nation filled with frustrated, angry, under or unemployed young men. In short, a nation a lot like today's Pakistan, where I also went. So soon thereafter, the country that had told its females to all get pregnant for the good of the nation was posting banners across roads reading, "One is good, two is enough." A new Ayatollah, the one who's still in power today, issued a fatwa stating that when wisdom dictates that you do not need more children, a vasectomy is permissible. A female OBGYN in Tehran, a devout Muslim woman, told me what it was like being on the teams of doctors that went on horseback to health clinics to the remotest villages and later by four-wheel drive and even helicopters, offering everything from condoms to pills to tubal ligations, all for free. But it was also all voluntary. Everybody could choose the number of children they wanted. The only obligation was to attend premarital counseling, either in a mosque or in a health center. And among the things discussed in those classes was how much it cost to feed, care for, and educate children. There was one other crucial part of Iran's family planning program, and that was they encouraged women to go to school, because women who are in school tend to postpone their childbearing until they complete their education. In fact, everywhere I went, even the poorest countries, female education is the most effective contraception of all. Because once she's out of school, a woman has some new and useful and interesting things to do with her life. She may very well want to be a mother, but now she also has a means to help make a living for her family, but it's hard to do when you've got seven kids hanging on your aprons. So the great majority of educated women in the world tend to have two children or fewer. In Iran, where today 60% of university students are female, population growth came down to replacement rate, meaning two parents produce an average of two children to essentially replace themselves, a year faster than China. Now, I know some of you know that just recently, Iran did an abrupt about-face and rescinded its family planning program that had become the poster program for the United Nations. I happened to be in Iran when that news came about. I was at a meeting of the oldest environmental organization in Iran, the chapter in the city of Esfahan. And it's basically a women's group. It was founded by a woman in Tehran. And to say that these women were livid would be an understatement. One hopes that if relations continue to thaw between our country and the new president of Iran, that this will be reconsidered. A lot of the reason for rescinding that were economic reasons and because of the sanctions that have been pressuring them. Now, population only increases in two ways. More people are born than die, or more people live longer, so they're around when others are being born. And for much of human history, our population didn't grow very much. It's sad to relate, but most babies were dead by their fifth birthday, if you can imagine the pain of our ancestors. The fact that the population grew so slowly until about two centuries ago, that means that even though a woman might have seven or eight, the average number of children who survived long enough to have kids themselves was barely more than two. An average life expectancy then was about 40 years. But then in 1796, Edward Jenner discovered a vaccine for smallpox, which used to knock back our numbers each year by the millions. And that was soon followed by vaccinations for other diseases and antiseptics, eradication of insects that carried epidemics, pasteurization of milk, and suddenly fewer were dying young and people were living longer. Now, none of us would ever argue that medical technology is a bad thing, because without it, most of us wouldn't be here. It's important to understand, though, that whenever we cure another disease, more people stay alive to beget more people. For years, Bill and Melinda Gates, like many others, have dedicated much time and money to eradicate diseases such as malaria and HIV. But in recent years, the Gateses have come to realize that solving one problem would exacerbate another on a stressed and stretched planet, so they are now major funders of family planning. Because whenever there are too many of us, it's increasingly more complicated to keep ourselves and human civilization and our planet healthy. But an even more significant boost to our numbers than modern medical technology came from modern food technology. Just before World War I, two Germans invented something that changed the world more than anything else ever. And that was a way to pull nitrogen from the air and to apply it chemically to soils. Before the Haber-Bosch process, the amount of plant life on the planet was limited to what a relatively few species that hosted nitrogen-fixing bacteria could contribute to the soil. Artificial nitrogen fertilizer simply blew the lid off of what nature could do. More than 40% of us would not be here without it. You take away artificial fertilizer and our population would be little more than half of what it is today. To a certain extent, Fritz Haber mitigated the population spurt he unleashed by also inventing the mustard gas that Germany used in World War I. And the cyanide-based pesticide fumigant he created to use in grain storage was later refined by Nazi chemists into Zyklon B, which is the gas used in extermination camps, which was made in a factory that Karl Bosch once headed. Now, both those men were fervent anti-Nazis, but they lost control of their creations. And some would argue that that not only applies to nerve gas, but also to nitrogen fertilizer, which has downsides that we all well know. Force-feeding our crops with chemicals sterilizes soils, fouls downstream waters, kills off chunks of the ocean at the mouths of our great rivers, the size of the state of New Jersey, and emits an awful lot of nitrous oxide as it breaks down, which is the most potent greenhouse gas after CO2 and methane. And because artificial nitrogen fertilizer is made from fossil fuels, essentially, we are all eating oil.
You are listening to Heart of Iowa on KHOY Community Radio. The presenter of this lecture is British author Alan Wiseman at a visit to the Iowa State University campus on February 24th.
Now, in 2009, Pope Benedict XVI wrote an encyclical. In this encyclical, he wrote, "On this earth, there's room for everyone through hard work and creativity." So when I went to the Vatican for this book, one of the questions I wanted to ask was, if by enough for everyone, the church meant just us or also other species, too. You remember that story about Noah. And also, there was the fact that the Vatican Pontifical Academy of Sciences, under John Paul II, he asked them to write a white paper about population, and to his dismay, they wrote back in 1994 that it was now unthinkable to sustain indefinitely a birth rate beyond two children per couple. The consequences would be unsustainable to the point of absurdity. Nevertheless, as we all know, the church still encourages population growth. So where, I asked the Pontifical Academy of Sciences current director, will we get the food for nearly 10 billion people by mid-century when already we have more than a billion who are hungry? You know, wouldn't clearing more forests for farming be disastrous? You know, plagued by floods and erosion, China alone is already spending $40 billion to put trees back. I went around China with a bunch of scientists showing me that. Well, the answer I was told in the Vatican was new transgenic crops that are being designed at the centers of the Green Revolution. That's the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Center in Mexico and the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines. Now, as most of you know, in the 1960s, just as burgeoning populations in the developing world were nearing the brink of famine, a miracle of genetic breeding occurred at those centers that more than doubled the world's grain harvests and in many places increased them up to tenfold. Green Revolution food technologies are often touted for debunking and refuting the dire predictions of inevitable famines as population growth outpaces food productions, predictions that were made by the economist Thomas Robert Malthus and his latter-day analogs, American ecologists Paul and Ann Ehrlich, who wrote the 1968 book, The Population Bomb. But when I went to both of those centers, I met no scientists who agreed that anything had been debunked. Actually, they said, when Green Revolution founder, Iowa's own Norman Borlaug, won the 1970 Nobel Peace Prize, in his acceptance speech, he didn't gloat. What he did was warn, by saying that there can be no permanent progress in the battle against hunger until the agencies that fight for increased food production and those that fight for birth control unite in a common effort. Now, Borlaug, who is credited for saving more lives than anyone in history, understood the paradox of food. The more we produce, the more people don't die of starvation, and they live to beget more people who need to be fed. And until his death, he served on the boards of population groups because he knew that food production can't keep up with the very population growth that it helps to produce. So as a result, we have all those hungry people on the planet. And despite everybody's best efforts, it's likely going to get worse. Because the first two places where the Green Revolution was tried were India and Pakistan. Both were saved from what seemed like certain famine. But as a result, in about a decade, India will surpass China as the most populous nation on Earth. And Pakistan's one of the fastest growing, and sad to say, one of the scariest places on Earth. Pakistan today has nearly 190 million people in a country not much bigger than Texas, which has 26 million. And by mid-century, if its growth continues apace, Pakistan will far outnumber today's United States with a projected 395 million, and it'll still be the size of Texas. And a significant portion of them are frustrated, angry, unemployed young men. And every day I was there, mayhem erupted, including two urban grenade battles. I lost one interview with two men who had been saving Karachi's mangrove forest because the previous day they were found floating in the lagoon, tortured and murdered by the local timber mafia. Pakistan's waxing out of control, and it happens to be a nuclear power. And in India, the head of the Punjab State Farm Commission, who directed the implementation of India's Green Revolution back in the 1960s, told me that India's three biggest problems are population, and you can complete that sentence. Three farmers who I met in his office, they were Sikhs, took me to their villages where I spent the day mostly interviewing widows of farmers who had killed themselves because levels in the 50-foot wells originally dug to water Green Revolution crops had now dropped to 50 and even 1,000 feet and beyond, and they couldn't afford to keep drilling. According to figures from their farm union, which I corroborated with the Indian government, 270,000 Green Revolution Indian farmers have committed suicide since 1995, and overwhelmingly the symbolic method of choice is by drinking pesticide. Half our people are sick from pesticides, heart attacks, high blood pressure, cancer, the farmers told me. Our kids have skin diseases and bad eyesight. No matter how much they eat, they're anemic. Their teachers call them slow learners. And their fathers, all 200,000 rupees in debt on every acre, all suicides in waiting, were all on each other's suicide watch. Well, today, more than half the human race lives not on farms, but in cities. And that's compared to only a third of us back in 1950. Since kids in urban areas aren't an economic asset to parents like they are on farms, it's been widely assumed that world population would level off around 9.2 billion by the middle of the century. But even though we're growing more slowly, there are still already so much of us that this past June, the UN's Population Division revised its projections and say now that our numbers will keep growing, hitting that figure nearly 11 billion by the end of the century with no sure peak in sight. In the next 50 years, Norman Borlaug's successor at the Weed Improvement Program told me, we need to produce as much food as has been consumed over our entire human history. And they're trying, he said. You know, geneticists there showed me what the Vatican had been talking about. These were experiments to try to hot rod photosynthesis to beat previous Green Revolution yields and possibly even give grains enough energy to fix their own nitrogen to minimize artificial fertilizer needs. But everyone said, even if they can do this, and they really don't know whether it's possible, but even if they can, commercially viable enhanced photosynthesizing crops are at least 25 years away. And by then, there's going to be 2 billion more of us. And agroengineers face another growing problem spawned by growing populations. As ever more of us expel more carbon, doing what we do, our overloaded atmosphere overheats the planet, and for every 1 degree centigrade of warming, scientists are pretty much in agreement that grain harvests are going to drop by 10%. Now, with our world currently headed beyond a 2 degree centigrade increase at present emission rates, that means the population is going to be up, food production is going to be down, irrigation water is going to be scarcer, and coastal dikes might have to protect much of the world's rice production, which is grown near sea level, which is probably unaffordable. And rosy predictions, you may have heard that northern Canada and Siberia will be breadbaskets in a warmer world, neglect that their conifer-covered acidic soils are going to take millennia to adapt to the needs of crops. Now, with 40% of the non-frozen earth now dedicated to feeding one species, our own, everywhere I went, I spent a lot of time researching that second crucial question. How much nature do we need to preserve to assure our own viability? How will we know if we push something off this planet that we didn't realize we needed until it's too late? I'm going to read you a little story about that at the end, but for now, a couple of examples. In Latin America, in this book, you'll meet ecologists who are part of a worldwide effort called the Natural Capital Project that are showing that nature is one of the biggest contributors to our economy in services that it provides. For example, coffee bushes in Costa Rica, the ones that are adjacent to the rainforest, have yields that are 20% higher than plants a kilometer away. Why? Because birds, bats, native bees, and reptiles were either pollinating or providing pest control, or doing both. In the Philippines, which is surrounded by the world's biologically richest seas, despite a national government that has long bowed to the world's most conservative Catholic bishops, I mean, ones who pride themselves in being more Catholic than the Pope, there's one suburb of Manila that now sends men to prison for 6 months if they buy condoms without a prescription. Nevertheless, in this Catholic country, I saw fishing villages taking matters into their own hand, including family planning, because they come to understand that if they want to keep fishing, which is the source of 90% of protein in a Filipino's diet, they have to keep the number of fishermen in balance with the fish stocks. Across the water from them, in Japan, in 1971, the last wild oriental white stork vanished. And in 1989, a stork hatchery at Toyoka, which is about an hour from Kyoto, successfully reproduced some using some breeding pairs from Russia. But the local rice fields, which were soaked each year with organomercury pesticides, were too toxic for the fledgling birds to be released, so they just kept them in cages. And then in 2004, a 10-year-old girl, schoolgirl, visiting that hatchery, heard that the storks had once filled the skies and nested on every chimney. And after learning why they no longer did, she went to the mayor and demanded that Toyoka serve organic rice for school lunches. Now, to do that would mean eliminating mercury, inviting back grasshoppers and other insects, but also making the rice paddies safe for storks. Now, the mayor, hearing the simple truth from a 10-year-old, could only agree. And his city's slogan became, an environment good for storks must be good for humans, too. The next plantings were pesticide-free. A year later, the first stork was released, and today, wherever they nest, the rice is twice as valuable because the presence of storks guarantees its purity. An economy that at bottom was rejuvenated, and today's tourists flock to Toyoka to watch hundreds of storks doing the same. Now, is this just a little story about a luxury food item, high-end organic rice? Actually not. This is a scenario that Japanese economist Akihiko Matsutani believes that Japan is headed to as one of the first countries on Earth whose population has begun to shrink. 4 years after World War II, Japan had to cut off its baby boom. Now, some of you might know that it started that war in the first place by invading Manchuria because its rapidly growing population needed more room. Then, after the war, which it lost because it just kept going, Japanese soldiers went home to their wives, like our soldiers, and Japan soon added 10 million more people. But its economy was wrecked, and people were starving, and pregnant women were literally throwing themselves in front of trains. So in 1949, in an emergency measure, Japan legalized abortion. Remember, this was before birth control pills. And millions of Japanese women partook, lest they watch one more baby die of hunger. So today, as that last aged, large generation that was born before the war begins to die off, there's a much smaller generation to replace them. And you add to that the high education and low fertility that naturally follows, and by the middle of the century, Japan's going to be approaching its World War II population again. And most Japanese economists are terrified by that. But Matsutani, who is no radical, but an economist at a major policy institute, sees it as an opportunity. When I met him, Japan had just compounded its shrinkage by losing its most fertile fruit-growing area, Fukushima, and all its nuclear power. Now, Matsutani envisions a gradual realignment away from heavy exporting industries in crowded big port cities to a dispersed economy of lighter industries in agriculture, distributed across a landscape that, because they're going to be following younger people who I watched and you see in this book, who are already going where land is becoming cheap and available as that large older generation passes on. Lifestyles, he predicts, will actually improve because wages don't drop. Laborers will be fewer and therefore more valuable. GDP nationally may drop, but GDP per person is going to stay the same. But working hours may also be fewer as demand shrinks with population. So prosperity will be defined, he says, to mean having more leisure time to enjoy rather than being able just to afford more consumer toys to occupy in too little downtime. And this is not a bad vision of a workable future, though many economists can't imagine it because to them the definition of economic health is perpetual growth. The late American economist Julian Simon, who was well known for preaching that human ingenuity ensured that resources would never run out, declared in 1994, he actually wrote this in his last book, "We now have the technology to feed, clothe, and supply energy to an ever-growing population for the next 7 billion years." Well, world population then was growing by 1.4% annually. So Paul and Ann Ehrlich checked his math and responded that that was probably unlikely because at those rates, within just 6,000 years, the mass of human population would equal the mass of the entire universe. It's true. And yet you still hear Simon cited today. He was invoked in that New York Times editorial I mentioned earlier. Look, otherwise intelligent people believe such nonsense because humans have never had to think about limits before. We're just not used to it. And you hear economists warning that if population ever stops growing, there's going to be far too few laborers paying into the pension funds to support too many old people. Well, actually, such economists really like large populations because the larger the population, the cheaper labor gets. You get a lot of poor people fighting over miserable jobs. And they also neglect the fact that unlike children, healthier senior citizens, as our senior citizens are now, remain economically productive, whereas children cost an awful lot until they finally graduate. But for a generation or so, until old and young come back into balance, we are going to have to adjust. And I know it won't be simple, but nothing in the 21st century is going to be simple. But we can do this gradually and acceptably. And frankly, I can think a lot of things that your country and mine spends money on, such as those little events that we threw in Iraq and Afghanistan, things that might be better spending that money by helping to care for a generation of senior citizens. Look, here's the bottom line. If we keep on the way we're going and growing, we're going to add 2.5 billion more people in the next 35 years, and they're going to have a much bigger and much dirtier impact than the last 2.5 billion because we've already used up the best lands and the cheapest energy resources. And yes, I know that population increase is mainly among the world's poor, and the richest fifth of the world's people consume up to 66 times as much as the poorest fifth, and that if we multiply our numbers by the amount that we consume, it turns out that we are all sitting in the most overpopulated country on Earth. But our numbers have now reached a point where we've essentially redefined the concept of original sin. Because every one of us, even the humblest among us, born into this world, compounds the world's mounting problems by needing food, firewood, and shelter. So the reason that I wrote this book was not just to ask if we can support the 11 billion we're headed to, but whether we're already too many. Because every species in the history of biology that exceeds the limits of its resource base suffers a population crash, sometimes even a fatal one. I really doubt that we're going to make it to 11 billion. One way or another, our population is going to come down. Either we're going to manage it gracefully, or nature is going to do it to us, and it's not going to be so pretty. Now, here's the good news. We can fix this and give relief to our precious environment for less money each year than my government was spending in a month in Afghanistan and Iraq. That amount, about $8.1 billion annually, would let us provide contraception for everyone on Earth who wants it. In this book, I accompany the people who make contraceptives available in places like Uganda, or Thailand, and Mexico, where women want and need them, and also the people who pay for them. I was staggered to learn how few donors there are out there. It's mainly a few Western governments and four private foundations. And I was also staggered to learn how fragile the supply lines are. If a shipment of contraceptive injections doesn't arrive, or the truck carrying birth control pills break down, or they disappear from the warehouse, as you women well know, you miss one crucial dose and all those careful efforts are for naught. The United States, I'm very pleased to say, is the biggest donor of all. And look, I assure you, I am not a member of a political party. I vote all over the place. But if someone else had won the last presidential election, President Obama's opponents promised that much of that crucial aid would have been canceled. And here's what could happen if we failed to provide it. Without contraception reaching those women in the developing world, our ranks could expand not by a million more hungry humans, not every 4.5, but every 2.5 days. 7 more Beijings a year. You put it another way. Forget all the UN population projections. Just 0.5 child more per woman, and we would be headed not to 11, but to 16 billion by the end of this century. Or if we provide contraception for all, and I do discuss in this book here the promising new and far simpler male contraceptives that are coming ready, just 0.5 a child per female fewer, and we'd be back down to 6 billion, which is well on our way to a sustainable future for our species, which each decade will be easier, not harder to feed. Does this sound far-fetched? Well, I fear it's a lot easier than coming up with enough zero-emission energy to run the world. We've been trying to tap free sunlight, etc., for years, and we must keep on trying. But we're still nowhere near capable of running all of our industries and vehicles and cities in India's and China's on solar and wind. And, of course, we know that there are a lot of very powerful forces dead set against letting that happen. We also don't know how to do something even more magical, convince everyone to consume less. Someone notes in this book, there's no condom for consumption. Look, we're all born addicted to energy, and that's it. This, however, doesn't require some enormous technological leap because it's technology that we already have. And if we combine contraception with education for females, we will tap one of the richest human resources of all. That same Viennese Demographic Institute I mentioned earlier recently calculated that if female education were universally available, there would be 1 billion fewer of us, not by the end, but by the middle of this century. And think of how all those educated women would help those feared labor shortages during a demographic transition back to sanity. A former World Bank economist, Herman Daly, has noted that to change the minds and hearts of economists, politicians, and voters in order to switch to a sustainable economy might seem impossible. But the alternative to a sustainable economy, an ever-growing economy, Daly wrote, is biophysically impossible. So in choosing between tackling a political impossibility or a biophysical impossibility, I judge the latter to be more impossible and take my chances with the former. What my research with Countdown has led me to conclude that we need to do in terms of our numbers is even easier than that, because the majority of places and people on Earth are already doing it. More than 0.5 the countries in the world are at, near, or below replacement rate. So we just have to do whatever it takes to help everybody else get the opportunity to do that too, by making the means available so everyone can choose the numbers of children they want and bring us gradually down towards a truly sustainable number rather than ask how we're going to do the impossible. Feed them all when we can't even feed the ones we have without messing up our planet even more.
You are listening to Heart of Iowa on KHOY Community Radio. The speaker is Alan Wiseman, who appeared on the ISU campus in February to share research on the global population crisis.
And now I'd like to close by reading you a little story from the book about that question of how much nature do we need? For centuries, the cultural fabric of Iran has been woven by Persian carpet makers. In a Turkish rug, each strand of yarn is knotted around 2 warp strands, but Persian rugs, it's 1 weft per each warp, so they're twice as tight. The tightest still made today have 144 knots per square centimeter. A rug like that from the wool of the bellies of spring lambs can take 2 people 8 years to finish. In Tehran's carpet museum hang old masterpieces created for royal families with 160 knots per square centimeter, woven by girls with sharp eyes and tiny fingers. One fabulously complex floral pattern that measures 320 square feet took 3 people working 10 hours a day, 18 years to complete. The principal weaver was 17 when she started and 35 when it was finished. Now, as a biology student in the 1960s, Esmael Karom would stare at rugs in the museum, such as one completed in 1416 that depicts the Tree of Life, which is a Zoroastrian symbol that predates Islam. Among its branches, he recognized turkeys, bustards, vultures, mynas, owls, doves, thrushes, flamingos, swallows, quail, parrots, ostriches, and partridges, and around the trunk crawled bears, turtles, alligators, beetles, centipedes, lions, and leopards. The depictions were so detailed that zoologists could determine each species. He was looking, Karom understood, at some creatures now extinct in his land. The eyes of ancient carpet weavers are how Iranian biologists today know what once lived there. Esmael Karom was the son of an Air Force pilot who, like his mother before him, was one of 12 children. As a boy, Karom's father would take him riding in Hosh Yalag, which is a wildlife refuge south of the Caspian Sea, whose name means good summer pasture. The grass there grew so tall that he would lose sight of the park ranger guide, and he had to stand on his horse's back to see where the stalks were moving to know which way to go. Hosh Yalag was then home to the largest population of cheetahs in Iran, and the sight of those fleet creatures thrilled him, so he resolved to become a naturalist. After graduating from the University of Shiraz, he became a field ornithologist with the Department of the Environment, and he traveled to every ecosystem in Iran. Eventually, he was appointed director of the Bureau of Wildlife, and he began a weekly television program that introduced viewers to the natural wonders of their country. His TV documentaries made Esmael Karom Iran's best-known naturalist. He took viewers to places like Miankaleh, which is a 48-kilometer sandy peninsula that's the last stretch of natural shoreline along Iran's 800-kilometer Caspian Sea coast. In the 17th century, the early 17th century, Shah Abbas of Persia's Safavid dynasty once killed 90 leopards and 30 tigers there. In 1830, Nasser al-Din Shah of the Qajar dynasty, who had 85 wives, wrote that early one spring morning he watched millions of migrating birds darken the skies for 4 hours. 50 years later, one of his many sons would take a group of friends to Miankaleh. With newly invented high-powered rifles, they shot 6,000 pheasants, 150 deer, 63 buffaloes, 18 leopards, and 35 tigers. And that same prince later described an area outside of Shiraz where hundreds of men hunted day and night. The mountain is so rich in wildlife, he wrote in his memoirs, that if the numbers of hunters were 10 times over, there would still be enough game animals for everybody. We stayed here 2 months, and when we were leaving, the number of animals was the same. Now, statements like these, Karom tell his audiences, prove that the Qajar hunters never set out to eradicate entire species of wild animals. In fact, they hoped to hunt forever. They considered natural resources such as wildlife and forests to be renewable resources that simply could not be exterminated by man. But all the species they prized are now rare or threatened or extinct. The mighty lion, the Caspian tiger, the Iranian wild ass, gazelles, bighorn mountain sheep, leopards, and the cheetah. Yes, the cheetah, he says, in his home near Tehran's Islamic Assad University. The walls there are trimmed with ornate molding, hung with brass wall sconces. Small Persian rugs cover the hardwood floors. The brick fireplace is flanked by paintings of migrating cranes and the endangered red-breasted goose that winters in Miankaleh. Above the mantelpiece, a 19th-century Tabriz tapestry declares in graceful Farsi calligraphy that God is the greatest protector of all. Now, whenever Karom is confronted by someone demanding to know whether it really matters if cheetahs disappear from the earth or if tigers go extinct, he tells them about one particular cheetah. It was where he least expected to encounter one. It was January 2003, and he was visiting America for the first time. A cousin in San Diego had married a schoolteacher who invited him to observe a sixth-grade class. He was charmed that the teacher had brought Iranian flag and Iranian coins to show the students. And when next she unrolled an exquisite crimson rug, his eyes widened. That rug, he knew immediately, was a pure silk paisley pattern from the holy city of Gom, worth thousands. Our guest is an ecologist, she told her students. Ecology, she explained, is the science of how everything on earth, people, plants, animal, fungi, microbes, rock, soil, water, and air is connected. All over the world, there are people who protect animals and plants so that the connections don't break. Dr. Karom is one of them. There was a knock on the door, and Karom gasped along with the sixth graders and as another teacher entered the classroom accompanied by a curator from the San Diego Zoo. The leash he held was attached to a muzzled cheetah. There are two populations of cheetah, said the teacher, one in Africa, the other in Asia. The Asiatic cheetah today lives only in Iran. Karom was amazed that this American woman knew something that he wished his own people comprehended. So what do you think would happen, she asked, if Asiatic cheetahs disappeared from the earth? Would it be a disaster? Would we be in trouble? Would you still be able to go to school? Would there still be gasoline for your father's car? Will we have electricity and water? Should we be concerned? Well, the students agreed that this elegant creature, silent on its haunches before them, deserved to live. But none thought that their world would come crashing down along with the cheetahs in the event it didn't. The teacher turned to the glowing silk rug draped on an easel. This beautiful Persian carpet belongs to an Iranian who lives in San Diego. It's made from more than 1.5 million knots. It took women years to do that. Now suppose a boy with a pair of scissors cuts a few knots from the edge. What'll happen? Nothing. You wouldn't even notice it. Now suppose that he returns and makes 200 knots disappear. Probably you still wouldn't notice it among the 1.5 million. But what if he keeps doing it? Soon you'll have a small hole. Then it'll get bigger and bigger. And eventually, nothing will be left of this carpet. Extending her arm, she pointed at the foliage outside and at the cheetah that was watching her as raptly as her students and Karom. This is the carpet of life. You are sitting on it. Each of those knots represents one plant or animal. They and the air we breathe, the water we drink, and our groceries are not manufactured. They are produced by what we call nature. And this rug represents that nature. And if something happens in Asia or Africa and a cheetah disappears, that's one knot from the carpet. And if you understand that, you'll understand that we are living on a very limited number of species and resources on which our lives depend. Thank you very much.
سلام لجواب يا عز حبيب إيه الأسباب عن عيني تغيب لسلام لجواب يا عز حبيب.
You have been listening to Heart of Iowa on KHOI Community Radio. We just heard Alan Wiseman reading from his new book, Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. Wiseman presented this talk at ISU this past February as part of the annual Conference on Wildness, Wilderness, and the Environmental Imagination. We are grateful to Wiseman and to the conference organizers for allowing us to broadcast this audio. More information about the speaker, his book, and the conference are on our website, khoyfm.org, under the Talk Programs tab, Heart of Iowa. I was your host today, Greta Anderson, and I edited the lecture to fit our hour format. Richard Morrison engineered the show. Thanks also to Chris Ling for production assistance. Our theme music is The Fisherman by Leo Kottke from his album 6 and 12 String Guitar. We also heard The Oud, played by Hamza Aldin. As usual, your listenership and generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.